Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dan Brenner, founder and CEO of 1N Health.
Prior to starting 1N Health in January 2019, Dan led client and portfolio development at Sprim and Sprim Ventures, leading all online initiatives for Sprim and its venture companies. And his prior startup experience includes the launching of Trinova and leading the brand to acquisition by Gold Eagle Company in 2016, joining the acquiring company's board in 2017. And Dan earned his MBA from the UCF College of Business. So thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate the introduction. A pleasure to be here.
Yes, thanks for joining us, Dan. So the first question I want to get into is, you know, as Lisa mentioned in her part of the intro, your background is largely in business growth. So could you describe your path into clinical research and patient recruitment into clinical trials?
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Andy. So my journey started out actually in life sciences, where I worked at life sciences focused management consulting firm called Sprim. And I worked with a variety of clients across pharma and nutraceuticals and helping them kind of define their product strategy and just doing kind of classical management consulting support. And then got the itch to do something more entrepreneurial and went and started a bunch of e-commerce businesses where I learned the direct-to-consumer marketplace and how to activate consumers online by selling physical goods. And I think, as Lisa mentioned in my background, one of those brands was Trinova, which we had a successful acquisition to a strategic name, the Gold Eagle Company. And so all of that coming back full circle, coming to Sprim, deciding to bring some of that digital native knowledge to the table for Sprim and its portfolio companies as it had a venture arm. And then what came to be quite obvious is that there was a chance to take kind of both of those sets of experiences in the life sciences side, but also in kind of the direct to consumer side, and bring what we call common sense patient recruitment solutions to patients, where we take some of the best practices of performance marketing and we bring them with a clinical viewpoint, where we're able to articulate more clearly what the offer is to the patient and get them into studies faster and with less friction, frankly.
So on LinkedIn, it notes that you were chair of the Gold Eagle Next Generation Board, a millennial group chartered to challenge and advise the Gold Eagle strategy from the perspective of the next generation. So can you elaborate on what millennials, next generations want from organizations they buy from or invest in right now?
Just a little bit of background. So after that acquisition with Trinova, I was asked to join the board of Gold Eagle as part of the transition. And one of the things that came up early on in those board meetings is that this was an 85-year-old manufacturing company, very classically entrenched. And they didn't really have a handle on what millennials or Gen Zers were wanting or needing, or really even how to speak to them. And so the idea came up is to actually create a second advisory board that would allow for millennials to basically be the board members and give insights on this 85-year-old, very classic, very old school company of how they might attack the marketplace in a way that resonates with this next generation of consumers. And so I chaired that board, and it was really a chance to give the leadership of that company a real insight into what these millennials are thinking, what's their buying criteria, how do they consider content, how important are advertising and the overall content strategy to go reach them. And so that was actually really illuminating and an interesting parallel with clinical research, because much like the automotive industry, which is where Gold Eagle lives, the clinical research industry is very, very classic, very old school in a lot of ways. And there's been a lot in the form of this direct to patient and decentralized clinical trials. But much of the resident knowledge it takes to activate some of those patients is almost lost in translation. And there's really not a thoughtful approach to activating people on the web. And so that is kind of the parallel between that next generation advisory board, how we're advising kind of this older company. And frankly, the philosophy that we're bringing at 1N Health is how do you reach people, not just the millennials or the Gen Zers, but folks that are online natives, folks that look at their newsfeed as a place where they get content, where they make decisions from, and ads, frankly, that they take action from. And so that's kind of where I've seen that parallel crossover, is being able to speak in kind of a way that those folks understand.
Great. Thanks, Dan. You touch on this a bit towards the end of that last response, but could you elaborate a bit more on how some of those insights tie into specifically patient recruitment or clinical trial strategy?
Sure. Patient recruitment, first of all, it is a crowded field and it is a broken one. There's no solution provider that's absolutely got, you know, double digit market share percentage in this space. It is a fragmented industry. And that speaks to a lot of the inconsistency or lack of effectiveness of kind of traditional approaches. And so what we've learned, so just one kind of nugget that I'll pull in here. If you go look at traditional online clinical trial recruitment ads, they look very much like they've been kind of photoshopped from a doctor's office pamphlet and thrown on the internet with the expectation that people will click. And I think it takes a kind of a more detailed approach to really understand those nuances that make somebody actually stop and read the ad, first of all, and then decide that they want to click, and then decide they want to fill out their information and ultimately get to enrollment. And so one of the things that we like to do is, I mean, you can call it social listening, but what we do is we go into patient communities, we look at how they're talking about their conditions, what are the ways that they frame the symptomology, what are the pieces of support that they're giving each other, what are the main pain points specifically around times of the month or times of the week related to their conditions, and we actually build that into the way that we communicate through our advertisements. So it doesn't necessarily look like we have a study, we need you, but rather, do you have this thing? Doesn't it stink that this happens? Would you like another approach that's investigational in nature that may be an interesting way to ameliorate your symptoms? These nuances sound small, but they're actually massive because the way that people think about their content that they consume is simply, what's in it for me? And so when we're able to put that lens on our ads, we find that engagement goes up, people are clicking, they're more interested in actually following through. And so simply just that nuance of shifting from a study-focused set of ads to a patient-focused set of ads actually creates huge outsized impact on what people do down funnel.
Do IRBs have to approve these ads?
Yeah, okay. IRBs do. And frankly, it's interesting you ask that question because we often get that question from sponsors. So do IRBs approve these ads? And the truth is, yes, we have, particularly in the US, we've never had an IRB tell us anything, but yes, this is good, go ahead. Typically, it's the sponsor's philosophies and kind of status quo of expectation of what ads should look like. That is what we have to kind of wrestle against before we even get to the IRB. Sponsors have a set of kind of old school understanding and methodologies of like, well, these are the ads that we did in the last study. And so we'll probably do something similar here. And when we roll out our creative, it definitely is starkly different than what they're used to seeing. And I'm talking like very, very detailed down to the patient experience, but also things like memes that typically never make it into advertising packets. But I think the IRB has seen enough to understand that this is just how patients communicate online. And so our job is to convince the sponsors with the data that we have that it actually does work and certainly it's compliant. But really, if they want to activate a holistic and diverse patient population, you can't speak in a clinical tone and you can't make people think that it's just about doctors in lab clothes, but it's about them.
So to that point, how do you bring that language down outside of that clinical tone?
So here's a really specific example. We were dealing with a migraine study, and the actual clinical term is that migraines can't be plural. It's just a migraine event. And so we went back and forth with sponsors and showed them screenshots of all of the patient communities that we did our research in. And we said, if we didn't make migraines plural, even though it's technically clinically incorrect, that people would feel like we're speaking from Mars, that they wouldn't understand exactly the context that we were going through. And so just a simple S on the end of the word just looks more human, but they had never done that before. They had always referred to it as a migraine disorder, but not necessarily the instance of migraines, plural. And so that's maybe a bit of a nuanced example, but certainly a tangible one where we've just had to show them the evidence that this is how the patients are talking. Let's talk to them that way.
So as you said, it is a crowded field. You know, there's a lot of companies coming into patient recruitment. With all these different models and pathways, how are companies such as yours able to differentiate yourself in this complex area?
That's a really exciting question. I'll just start out by saying that patient recruitment is really complicated and filling studies is the number one issue with getting studies done. So I don't believe that I'm espousing a one-size-fits-all approach or, you know, One End Health's approach is the only one that can work. I think that in many cases, you really need all hands-on-deck approaches, specifically with rare diseases. So with that as the backdrop, I'll say that there's the main categories that you mentioned. So like EHR mining, looking through med records, collecting a bunch of folks in a database that might want to raise their hand when the time comes, or doing what we do, which is primary proactive recruitment. So finding a specific patient for a specific study. We believe that there are places for all of those. The reason why not only have we chosen to focus solely on proactive outreach and not database mining, in fact, we don't even retain any of the information of people that we would recruit for a particular study, is because recency is so important. So rather than having a database of 300,000 people or whatever in a particular TA, let's take migraines again, The truth is that those folks are only most interested the very second that they've clicked on some other call to action. And so keeping them in a database for 6 months often isn't the way to keep them warm and activated, but rather capitalize on the moment in time where they've expressed interest. And that's why we believe this primary recruitment is so important for research. The other piece that we do that is specifically interesting and we believe is kind of our, we'll use the business term, a unique selling proposition to the industry, is that we take a technology-centric view of activating these patients. And that doesn't just mean we're using the internet to recruit them. It means that we use common sense technology tools to bring them through the clinical operations funnel. So I'll give an example of a study that we rescued. So this was for an anxiety disorder study. The incumbent recruitment company was one you probably have all heard of. And the 20 sites that were responsible for this phase two were seeing very, very little follow through, very little follow up with the patients that had actually filled out the screener. And when we took over the recruitment, we looked at the funnel and we found that the way that the clinical operations approach was going was people would submit their information online to be qualified for the study, and then the sites would call them to try to schedule an appointment, which sounds extremely innocuous. That's normally what you would expect. However, we looked at it a little bit differently, particularly from the therapeutic area perspective, which is if people have anxiety disorder, getting a phone call from a medical research site about your anxiety sounds like maybe the most terrifying possible thing that could happen. And so
it really does.
we actually recast the entire ClinOps process so that there was a little bit more warming up happening. And we use that with our technology. So we installed a chatbot function. So once an individual was qualified, they received a text saying, hey, it looks like you're a good fit for the study. Respond yes if you're still interested. Keep in mind that at some point, somebody will have to reach out and talk to you on the phone. And then those people that responded yes, that was a warm lead. And then the next one was like, okay, great. It sounds like you're still interested. Somebody from whatever phone number is going to call you within the next 48 hours. Does that sound good? Respond yes. And then those folks would respond yes. And so now you've got these people now having two little tiny steps to kind of alleviate whatever anxiety they might be feeling at that first phone call to just let them know what's happening. And the results were insane. I think on that particular study that I mentioned, we 2.5x the ICFs per week per site just by taking it up and adding those nuances. And I think obviously our content approach and the way that we activated those patients across online channels help. But sometimes it's as simple as just using technology to speak to the, not just the language of the patient, but also to the medium of the patient. Sometimes people don't want to answer the phones, especially in CNS conditions where anxiety is at play.
That's really, really a good point.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So the next question I have is, can you discuss how industry can best harness patient data to accurately predict recruitment timelines and the overall health of a study's recruitment campaign?
So this is, again, is tricky. And I like, this is not One in Health has come off the mountain with the two stone tablets and here are the recruitment 10 commandments. I think that there's a lot of nuance to these elements of being able to accurately predict timelines, especially in an industry where sites often will overproject the amount that they're capable of or don't necessarily get the support that they'd like from the sponsor. And so I think that there are some headwinds that, you know, I can't necessarily address today because it's not my niche, but I think that there's lots that can be done in kind of making those timelines more stable. But here's one specific thing that we do to make sure that we're not another recruitment vendor that's just promising kind of pie in the sky timelines to hit a study LPI. One of the things that we do before we even actually sign a proposal is we actually run the study ads. We actually take a little subset, we run 5 or 7 ads to the TA, we mock up the IE, we put it on a screener, we put it all around the internet, and we get actual people clicking through asking if they'd be interested in a study like that. And while that's not a perfect example or a perfect apples to apples, it is a really good proxy because people that express interest in joining a study like that are typically the same types of patients that actually do want to join the study when it's ready. And so we call these enrollment model validations or EMVs. And so before we even get to a response to a sponsor or to a CRO on a recruitment quote, what we'll do is we'll put these together. We'll put some creative in the field. We'll put it across ad platforms. And then we'll evaluate things like click-through rate. What percent of the people that see these ads are actually clicking through? We'll look at things like submission rate. What percent of the people that get to the screener form actually put in their information? And then we'll evaluate the IE by looking at the qualification rate. What percent of the people that submitted their information would have actually qualified on this study? And so instead of looking at, you know, studies that might have been similar 6 months ago or TA experience that we have where we can, you know, expect what's going to happen, the internet and its people are very dynamic and sometimes fickle. And so unless you have really, recent information on a really specific, precise study, often the expectations or enrollment projections are pulling kind of numbers out of the air. And so what we do is we take those quantitative insights that we get from actual field study, and we put it through our model, and we actually are able to project based on the number of sites, based on geographic locations, and based on the enrollment model validation results. We're actually able to get pretty good results of what we can expect. And then when we actually do win the study and we're in the field, we find that they're actually parallel, that the things that we saw when we did our EMV are exactly what we see when we're running the full recruitment initiative. And this is one of the reasons, and this is where I'm like hedging by trying not to brag, but slightly doing it anyway, so forgive me. It's one of the reasons why 90% of our studies enroll on time and on budget, is because we're not guessing. This enrollment modeling is a really, really tricky thing, especially in an industry where 85% of studies don't enroll on time. People have been burned because they're just kind of used to people saying, yeah, we can do that. So we've tried to take it up a notch and making sure that we de-risk it for sponsors. But frankly, because we're a performance-incented company, we only get revenue dollars when patients enroll. We have to de-risk it for ourselves. And so it makes logical sense for us and for the sponsor to have those types of data sets available prior to even going to a bid defense, because we know exactly what we're going to get if we get onboarded.
So that's an interesting statement that you made, that internet audience is dynamic and fickle. I've always thought that patient recruitment is the hardest thing to do because you are dependent on someone else's behavior, you know, to follow through with this. So interesting that you take that and turn it around so that it really is customized to the patient. But does that kind of customization lead to extra cost, do you think? Or
yeah, Lisa, no? And that's a great question. And frankly, it was a question of ours before we started doing these on nearly every RFP that we get, but we do them now. And it's because it's better to spend a little bit of money to find out the answer than to go commit your reputation, the promises to the sponsor, promises to patients, and be wrong. And so, yes, we do this at our own cost. It's not cheap, but it is a way for us to be able to tell sponsors what they can expect and have them have confidence that we know what we're talking about. And it's not because like we just present a certain level of certainty. Our certainty is derived from data. It's not from what we think is going to happen. It's from what we have data to support. So yes, and I think just one other piece I want to address, the point you made about, you know, patient recruitment is so hard because it depends on the behavior of another. Yes, this is another huge, huge piece, because it's not just the behavior of internet audiences to go click on ads and then go fill out forms, but also how do we partner with sites to be able to make sure that there's a certain level of the framing, it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. Without sites, we really can't do our jobs, right? Without those CRAs and schedulers and in-house recruitment people, we can't get people in the door. And so we see, as much as we put the patient first, we also want to put the sites first, because we don't want to overwhelm them with leads that don't answer the phone. We don't want to promise a bunch of lead volume that never comes. We don't want to have too much lead volume where they feel like they can't even address it. And so a lot of what makes our relationships with sites successful is just a two-way communication street, where we're able to talk about how volumes are doing. What are they seeing from these patients? Are they picking up the phone like we thought they would? Are they not? Are there things that we can do with our technology to make the experience more streamlined for everyone? And, you know, we know that sites have a lot of systems, they have a lot of studies, and they don't necessarily love additional technology options. But I think they find that going through the process with us and seeing how they're able to dashboard their leads and being able to work them properly and not being overwhelmed with people that aren't picking up the phone actually creates what you would call a surprising effect, where they're actually more excited, more engaged to call our leads and maybe work on some other studies where the leads aren't as high quality.
So as clinical trials continue to move into this more technology-enabled enterprise, what trends or implications do you see for the next 2 to 5 years?
So I'm no fortune teller, but I've been known to speculate. I have what I'll call a pretty strong hunch for the next couple of years, and then I'll dream a bit for beyond that. So I think one of the things that's happening, and we've all seen what has been going on in the DCT space, and I think that is probably a good proxy for looking at capital T technology in the space overall. And one of the things that is probably going to happen next is many of these DCT companies will have to consolidate, either merge with one another, be scooped up by other CROs, maybe even some sponsors. And that consolidation is going to kind of be the domino that I believe creates a bunch more integrations, where you have all of these disparate sets of vendors operating with CROs as quarterbacks. And I think what you're going to see is that there's going to be more integrations amongst systems between some of recruitment players like us. We're doing this now. Some DCT players all around the space, from all the way to CROs and ultimately to sponsors. And so I think those integrations will make what looks more like a vertical supply chain rather than this disparate collection of vendors where Excel sheets are still being passed back and forth and everybody's trying to get into the CTMS. I think there's a lot of that happens before that, that will have to be integrated for it to all work together well. So I'll pause there if you have a follow-up, but I think that would be the next big piece of change to take place in this new year and beyond.
No, it sounds pretty much like you're a fortune teller. I mean, an accurate one. Can you tell me like what my future is going to be? No. I'm kidding.
have a fortune cookie tonight and tell me what it says.
No, that's awesome. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that, you know, we see consolidation at certain times in the industry and it has been a lot of movement. It just feels like, you know, pre-COVID, a lot of stuff was going on. Clearly it was developing during COVID and then boom, you know, but so is there anything else that you wanted to add, Dan?
One more piece, and mm-hmm. this is the part where I wanted to dream a little. I think even though cryptocurrencies are, and I really don't want to sound like a witch doctor here, so just bear with me. even though cryptocurrencies are on fire in the market right now and Web3 hasn't caught on like everybody thought it would, I want to talk about how ChatGPT and OpenAI represents what I think is a good use case example of technology proliferation. And so there's this concept that's been out there a while, you know, individuals should be able to hold their medical records on the blockchain, be able to give access to any or all of those to whomever they choose. And the thing that's been missing is kind of that ChatGPT proliferation. People need something that they actually want to use that makes their life easier, that isn't a root canal to get started on. And I think ChatGPT represented kind of that iPhone effect where everybody wanted to use it. Everybody wanted to put their prompt in. And so I think if you want to dream a little bit bigger in the next 5 to 10 years, I think there's a chance for someone to come into this space, particularly on the EMR side, and let people tokenize their health records and use that as a place where they're able to actually and excitedly capture them, transfer them to whomever they choose, and keep that token so that they can relay whatever medical information that they want along the way. I think that is more of a 5 to 10 year piece, but ChatGPT is a really interesting catalyst to help us realize that these technologies that we had never really experimented with can sweep through the nation or the world simply because it's so cool and because it's so captivating. And I think that there's an opportunity to do the same with medical records.
I like it.
Call me in 2033 and let's see how we did on that one.
I like it. Thank you so much.
You know, once again, Dan, you know, thanks for joining us. This was a great conversation and yeah, you know, definitely learned a lot about the technology space and all that good stuff. And it was nice to hear your predictions for the future as well.
Indeed. It is the time of the year for predictions. So exactly. We'll see how everything shakes out. Andy, Lisa, thanks for being great hosts. Thanks for having me on. Glad that I was able to get to do it.